Talk of the Nation. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Sometimes science fiction is used as a term of dismissal, as in, that's just science fiction. But not all of that genre warrants that just. Certainly some of it is parody, but some of it is prophecy. To wit, space travel, predicted in 1865 by Jules Verne, credit cards in 1887 by Richard Bellamy, global communications satellites in 1945 by Arthur C. Clarke, and so on. And still, science fact is following on the heels of science fiction. Sci-fi innovations now in actual development include intelligence agents sent by people to sift through information on the internet, nanotechnology, microscopic machines made of biological material, bioengineered implants that can repair our bodies and extend our lives. Of course, just because a sci-fi writer says it doesn't make it so.
So these are just ordinary photographs. What do you do to them?
I just developed the film as normal, and for some reason they've come to life.
It's the developing fluid. It must have mutated.
But Thomas Edison said he owed his inspiration to Jules Verne, and Teddy Roosevelt and FDR invited H.G. Wells to the White House. And today, science fiction writers appear across the table from the captains of cyberspace, a term coined, by the way, by one of our guests. So today we talk about the science of science fiction with three practitioners of the art: William Gibson, the aforementioned author of the term cyberspace and such books as Neuromancer, Mona Lisa Overdrive, and Virtual Light. Welcome.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thank you. And David Brin, astronomer, professor, and author of Foundations Triumph, Infinity Shore, The Postman, among others. Welcome to you.
It's great to be back on Talk of the Nation.
And Anne Simon, associate head of the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of Massachusetts and science advisor to the TV fantasy The X-Files, about which she's written a new book called The Real Science Behind The X-Files. And here's your chance to ask, could that ever happen? Transporters, time machines, viruses that think, dinosaurs cloned? Could the human race have been seeded by aliens? If you want to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And to send an email, you can write to totn@npr.org. Just include your name and where you're writing from. Okay, so thank you, all three of you, for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
I'd like to begin, actually, with you, Ms. Simon, with a question from Julian in Oakland, because it's right up your alley. Julian?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
The point I wanted to make is I've noticed on programs like Star Trek, the various Star Trek shows, and Farscape, Babylon 5, and so on, that they seem like they do okay when they're talking about the hard sciences, physics, astronomy, various forms of space travel. A lot of the things are far-fetched, but they're things that might be possible with sufficient technological development. But where they almost always seem to get it wrong, and unfortunately X-Files does this too, is in the biological sciences. They always have people changing into other things. I can't think of any possible way that I could change into a crustacean, for instance.
Anne Simon.
Well, Julian,
it's just not possible.
Well, you're absolutely right. It isn't possible. You will never become a starfish. But the X-Files, shows like the X-Files, you know, Farscape, they're science fiction. I mean, they're not supposed to make sense. They're not supposed to be real. But what we try to do on the X-Files is at least make what the scientists are doing be real. So where they're analyzing some pretty fantastical creatures like Fluke Man, half worm, half man, something else that you'll never turn into, it's what the scientists are doing that makes the show seem more accurate. So it's in this realm that I try to help. I'm not one to say to the creators of the show, you can't do that, you can't have a Fluke Man, because it is science fiction after all.
For instance, when X-Files showed some DNA that was clearly of extraterrestrial origin, you ensured that DNA would have been of extraterrestrial origin.
That's right. I got asked, what could a scientist find that would immediately scream out, this creature I'm analyzing is extraterrestrial? So I simply thought about what we all share, what all creatures on the planet share. We all share DNA. We all share DNA with the same four chemicals, the same four nucleotides. So if there was a creature that had DNA with six chemicals, six nucleotides, it would be by definition extraterrestrial. So it's using science with a science fiction twist is how I like to say it.
If I could comment briefly on the problem that Dr. Simon faces in being the technical advisor for the X-Files. X-Files I would not call science fiction in any way. I would call it science fantasy, which means that the writers are free to come up with any dreamlike image that is scary enough, as if they wake up from a nightmare, and put it into their story. And then Dr. Simon has the difficult task of trying to supply dialogue that ties it to our world and makes it seem plausible. And the one thing that she's partly responsible for that earns my great respect is when the Agent Scully, the female FBI agent, when she has these lyrical 5 or 10 minute episodes in which she's doing all this lab work and she falls back upon her faith in science and some of the dialogue that she says, it's her touchstone. These are lyrical moments of faith in science that are inserted into an otherwise dreamlike scenario, which is what The X-Files is, because The X-Files is driven by dramatic needs, which is why there are never any answers. The truth is out there, but the viewers will never, ever see it.
And what do you mean by dramatic needs?
Well, one might call it the idiot plot. You have a dozen spoiled teenagers in a haunted house, pardon me, and the lights go out, somebody screams, and then you have to have someone say, I know, let's split up. Because in order to keep your heroes in jeopardy for 60 minutes of a teleplay or 90 minutes of a movie or 600 pages of a cheap novel, you have to have people making grotesque mistakes.
Errors in judgment. We did horror
that's
yesterday
right.
on this program.
That's right. And it's the exceptions to this rule that actually shine in cinema, like The Fugitive, Silence of the Lambs, Ransom, where you... The hero dials 911, and they are actually members of a society that send skilled professionals to help them, like we would expect if we dialed 911. And despite that, the writer is still able to keep the heroes in jeopardy for 90 minutes. That's challenging. But most modern dramas don't do that.
We've sort of gone off... I'm sorry, David.
But good science fiction does that.
Mm-hmm. Julian, is your question answered? Or I guess he's gone. Okay. Well, I mean, my feeling is about the X-Files that it's the science that is particularly satisfying when you see them going through the process of their research, even when the events are so extraordinarily unlikely. There are viruses that act in strange ways. There are slugs that will either eat each other or have sex with each other, depending on the circumstances. And these kinds of creatures that do exist in our world find their sort of larger size analogies, it seems to me, on the X-Files.
Well, what we do try to do on the X-Files, though, is we don't try to have a virus do something that it can't do. Viruses are very dear to my heart since I work on viruses as a scientist. So we don't have a virus, for example, turning into a horrific creature, but a virus can get inside a cell, and it can cause the cell to activate a resident genetic program that we didn't know was present, and it can then have the cell start dividing, and eventually the cell turns into the creature. So it's important to keep things, you know, a virus can't become something it can't be. But it can actually do things that in the real world it can do. I mean, viruses can get into cells. Viruses can change the molecular biology of what's going on in the cells.
And viruses can change the behavior of the animals that carry them.
Well,
or parasites can.
Parasites can. Viruses are just a bag of genes, yeah. So it's not going to do very much except try to reproduce and make more of itself.
Let's go to Scott in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hello, Scott.
Greetings, Earthlings. I'm calling from Michael Hugo's Science Fiction Bookstore, which certainly David Brin and William Gibson are familiar with. And thanks so much for your great ideas and so much fun. In 1968, Willie Ley was asked the question, how come We see things in science fiction, and 15, 20 years later, they're in our houses. Why are they so accurately predicted? And he answered by saying that writers and technicians both read the same scientific journals, where writers can beat away on the typewriter, then now word processor, and come out with a short story in a matter of weeks or a novel in a year or so. The technicians have to go into the lab and work on things for, he thought then, 15 to 20 years. Now we're probably down to maybe 5 years. But it was merely a question of reading the same scientific journals and applying their craft.
I wonder if that's the case. William Gibson, do you read scientific journals? Because you've been incredibly foresighted in your prediction of cyberspace, and you've created the most enduring image of what we imagine the future will be.
I read very little technical literature at all. And actually, I spend a lot of my time, a lot of my media time, trying to disown my prescience.
Why is that?
Because it's just not, you know, it would be less than honest. You know, as I've said many times, the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. And I see what I do as you know, pointing in the very general direction of the parts where change is emerging. And that these changes emerging sufficiently quickly these days that can very easily pass for prescience if you don't look at it too closely.
So you say that you're not forecasting? The worlds you create certainly are not yet with us.
I would say that I'm actually writing about an unthinkable present, and that I'm using science fiction as a pair of oven mitts to handle a contemporary reality that's actually too much for most of us.
Scott. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please. Well, this is David Brin. I was just going to add to what Bill said there, that even those of us who do relatively well at prophecy in some of our science fiction works don't claim that that's our chief job. I mean, you can point to wonderful episodes of prescience. E.E. Hale, the man who wrote Man Without a Country, in 1868 predicted communications and navigation satellites in a short story that was published in Atlantic Monthly. But the actually, in my opinion, the most powerful form of science fiction is not the where you get it right, but where people like George Orwell and H.G. Wells and Aldous Huxley made what were called self-preventing prophecies. Prophecies like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and the movie Soylent Green that helped to arm us emotionally and mentally to fight the environmental fight to save the Earth. Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove, which helped to prepare us to prevent accidental nuclear war. These are examples, and of course the most powerful self-preventing prophecy, George Orwell's 1984, which almost all of us use as metaphors in our minds to fight tyranny.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Scott. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, and I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll continue talking about the interaction of science fiction and science fact, and we'll also continue taking your calls at 800-989-8255. If you would like to send an email, just write to totn@npr.org and include your name and where you're writing from. At 21 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and today we're trying to find the science in science fiction. My guests are David Brin, astronomer and author of Foundation's Triumph. He's at the NPR member station, KPBS, in San Diego, California. And Simon, professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and author of The Real Science Behind the X-Files, Microbes, Meteorites, and Mutants. She's speaking to us from NPR member station WFCR in Amherst. And William Ford Gibson, science fiction writer and originator of the term cyberspace. He's author of the cyberspace trilogy, Neuromancer, Count Zero, and Mona Lisa Overdrive, and he's in the studios of Canadian Broadcasting Company in Vancouver, British Columbia. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And why don't we go to David, or David, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. David, thanks for holding.
Good afternoon. How are you?
All right.
I have a question for Mr. Brin. First off, I want to say thank you for his latest short story. I thought it was just marvelous, like the rest of his work. And I was wondering, having been raised Mormon myself, where he got the inspiration for his story. And whether he thinks there's anything true to it.
I think you're talking about Stones of Significance, which
yes.
appeared in this month's Analog magazine.
That's
Stones of Significance. Stones of Significance is actually very pertinent to this topic because one of the things that, and by the way, thank you for your earlier comment. One of the things that science fiction is talking about now is the possibility that things might go astonishingly well, amazingly well, even terrifyingly well. It's a concept that was bizarre until we've had 8 years of this economic growth that's making everybody very nervous, wondering when the party's going to end. And right here in San Diego, we have a Hugo Award-winning science fiction author named Werner Vinge, who has coined the term singularity. That's having to do with the idea that perhaps our progress may keep accelerating faster and faster and faster and faster to the point where our abilities, our knowledge, essentially make us godlike within the next 20 to 30 years. If things accelerate, if you actually follow the curve of the last 20 to 30 years of human knowledge, and look at the forward on the internet, it's frighteningly plausible. Then you add in things like nanotechnology, which might clean our bodies out of all the toxins and do repair, effectively making our bodies immortal. This is one avenue that science fiction explores. Bill Gibson, on the air today, explored a different image, one that you can see vividly depicted in the movie Blade Runner, which is sometimes called the cyberpunk image, and that is that we'll keep getting more high-tech, but human wisdom won't increase alongside it. So we'll have a highly stratified culture. The future won't arrive. It's unevenly distributed. You'll have dark powers, elites controlling things with teeming masses down below. These are two different views of what we may be coming toward, and I like to think that the cyberpunk view is an example of what I spoke of before, the self-preventing prophecy.
I hope so, too. One last question, since you brought it up. What are your favorite Philip K. Dick novels?
I was going to say Blade Runner is based on a Philip K. Dick story.
Blade Runner, of course, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Almost anything by Philip K. Dick would blow your mind.
The Man in the High Tower?
The Man in the High Castle, yes, he was...
The Three Stigmata of them, sorry, don't get me started.
Palmer Eldritch, yes, you're a fan.
That's the best one, yeah. Palmer Eldritch.
Yes, terrific.
Thank you for your call, David.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go to Scott in Jackson, Michigan. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
The thing I'd like to bring up today is, I'm glad you used an example from Star Trek in the beginning of the show, because one of the most common criticisms that has always been made about Star Trek and other so-called space operas, including, you know, Star Wars, is that if you're a big fan of Albert Einstein, I've always heard that Albert Einstein theorized that, in point of fact, nothing in the universe, no matter, is capable of exceeding the speed of light anyway. So you have these vast space operas which are based on this idea that you have, like, the Star Trek Voyager, which can, you know, travel, you know, many, 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 many times the speed of light. And actually, you know, the whole chronology of their stories wouldn't make any sense if you didn't have something like Warp 8, okay? So where this, you know, is perhaps coming into collision, you know, with scientific fact is that I understand that in the last 2 years, the Hubble Space Telescope apparently has observed gas clouds orbiting around a black hole. And as these gas clouds are, of course, being drawn into the black hole and its irresistible force of gravity, that apparently, according to their observations, these gas clouds have been clocked at traveling in excess of 186,000 miles an hour. That, in point of fact, we now have at least observed data which says that, yes, there is some matter can travel faster than the speed of light. So here's an example where you have a man who was a literal scientific prophet in many ways. He was more of a theoretician than anything else. And it's amazing that, you know, so many of Albert Einstein's theories were ultimately confirmed, not by Einstein, you know, but by other scientists, you know, things like nuclear fission and stuff. But here we have an example where, you know, we have what seems to be an emerging scientific fact, which actually is in conflict with, you know, one of... Not one of the fiction writers, well, but actually one of the great, you know, theoreticians
of science. As the astronomer on this panel, I have to tell you that, well, first off, it's 186,000 miles per second is the speed of light, not per hour. But the other point is that many of these things that we observe in space that seem to be traveling faster than the speed of light turn out to be very, very interesting optical illusions. Now, Kip Thorne at Caltech and a number of other great physicists have said that it is not absolutely excluded that we might someday find some way of cheating and going faster than light, but that if it is, it will cause severe theoretical problems, and we'll have to be smarter than we are now. The question is that if you're going to have a really dramatic story, then some things are going to be driving the plot. Like I was speaking of before, in The X-Files, the plot driver is dreams and the need to never get explicit. In Star Trek, the plot driver is the need to go from place to place and have interesting exploratory adventures. So hyperdrive in science fiction is sometimes a gimme in order to drive the rest of the story, which sometimes concentrates on plausible, realistic science.
Well, thank you for your question, Scott. What's the possibility, then, of warp drive coming to be? Is there any science behind it?
If I were going to be bet on what my descendants would have in the next about 300 years from now, I would give 3-1 odds against there ever being a warp drive. And a lot of good science fiction now has bitten the bullet to try to do dramatic stories where you go to the stars in suspended animation, for instance. Your body is frozen, and then or a computer may build a new copy of you and download your consciousness from memory into it. So there are new ways that science fiction is trying to deal with this. Nevertheless, there are some quirks in nature that even the best physicists like Kip Thorne believe may offer our descendants, or even us if we have that breakthrough I spoke of earlier, even us the opportunity to see if maybe something like warp drive exists. The biggest reason to believe that it doesn't exist is that we see no signs of aliens here now.
But a sliver of possibility. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Stefan in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Stefan, hello.
Actually, the name is Stephen. But
Stephen.
Close enough. A lot of us from Michigan calling today. I am actually a science fiction writer here in Grand Rapids, and something that always disturbs me when I hear discussions of science fiction is the loose usage of the term science fiction. Science fiction is not the same as speculative fiction or fantasy. Science fiction, by a strict definition, is fiction based upon science. Larry Niven was very good with this, with the Ringworld novels, with the use of faster-than-light travel using, I can't remember what the term was now, somebody else could probably help me out with that. Mm-hmm. But he was very good at sticking to science in his science fiction. It was fiction about science.
I think that now the terminology has just shifted a little. Now we talk about hard science fiction.
Right.
Say the blue Mars, Green Mars series, as opposed to science fiction that is less based on science.
Exactly. And what happens is, the reason why this becomes an issue for me as a writer is you present something. I primarily write speculative fiction. It's
Stephen, could you plug your last name, please?
I'm sorry.
Take it.
I read under a pseudonym, so that probably would be.
Learn from the older guys. Plug your last. plug the name of the name you use, and then go on with your question.
I really don't want to do that.
All right.
You'll never make it in this business, Stephen.
My publisher would absolutely kill me. Don't criticize.
But go ahead. So you write speculative fiction. Don't listen to these guys. Get through your sentence.
Anyway, what really disturbs me is when you start mixing up science fiction, speculative fiction, and fantasy, because as soon as you present a decent theory in either the science fiction or the speculative fiction aspect of your writing, somebody lumps it in with fantasy, and you've got people riding dragons shooting laser guns. The power of science fiction is that, exactly as the topic of the show is, these are things that could actually happen. You guys probably are more familiar with this story than I am. You could probably name the magazine. I think it was Amazing. Had their offices raided by the FBI during
Astounding.
World War II.
It was astounding.
It was astounding. Had their offices raided by the FBI during World War II because they'd been writing these stories about this big, huge weapon, and it turns out the FBI was trying to find out who was leaking secrets about the Manhattan Project. Nobody had. These were just ideas that the writers came up with on their own. So the power of science fiction is the ability to stick to the science. And it has a very good place. Speculative fiction has its own place because speculative fiction actually does very well. What Star Trek did was it addresses some of the moral issues. For instance, Dr. McCoy was afraid to use a transporter because it destroyed his body. Therefore, when he reconstituted him, did he have a soul? Was he dead? Was he alive? These are religious issues and philosophical issues that science has to address. And I think that's one of the important roles that science fiction plays.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Does anybody want to comment on that? I wanted to ask, actually. Oh, I'm sorry, David. I jumped in.
Only that I disagree slightly, in that I think that science fiction is a bit more general than that. In that science fiction is the form of literature that deals with the effects of change on human beings, whether we handle it maturely or, as happens in cautionary tales, whether we make mistakes. And a subcategory of that is scientific science fiction. Bill, did you have a comment?
Oh, I have a deeply ambivalent relationship with genre myself. I'm never certain whether I am a science fiction writer or not. I think it's where I'm from, in that it's my native literary culture. What I'm increasingly aware of as my own work leads me back to the world is that change today is societal change is primarily driven by emerging technologies, and emerging technologies are never legislated into existence. So in a new and interesting way, or maybe in a newly apparent way, everything is out of control.
To plug a book by that title by Kevin Kelly, a very
Well, I wanted to ask, and Simon, I read in your book that you used to look at your father's scripts and read
them
as a kid.
That's right. My father wrote science fiction. Well, what I would call science fiction movies, not being the literary person that the other two guests are, and just being someone who likes to read science fiction and being a scientist, I guess I don't categorize things quite the same way as people who are really into the genre would. But yes, I used to love reading his scripts. He wrote a movie called Marooned, which was certainly science fiction at what I think we're all calling hard science fiction at the time. And he did a great deal of research on that to get Marooned as accurate as possible.
Terrific movie.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay. Anne, I wanted to ask you about the proposition that I stated in the intro that science fiction brings people into science. Was that your case?
It was my case. I always liked science fiction ever since my fourth grade teacher read Wrinkle in Time, the Madeleine L'Engle book to the class, and I was just fascinated by it. And so I started reading science fiction rather voraciously and did end up going into science. I must say that when I teach my introduction to biology students, that I've asked a number of them, you know, what got you interested in science? And I was really amazed at how many of the students pointed to The X-Files and the fact that science was presented on the show in such a realistic fashion and that they liked what the scientists were doing on the show, that the image of scientists on the show was so positive. And if you think about the way scientists are being portrayed in the media, they're being portrayed in a very negative way. And I think what The X-Files does so well is to portray scientists in a much more positive light.
Let's go to Pamela in Woodland Hills, California. Pamela.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question regarding research. Tips for an aspiring writer who would like to do research in physics or biology and get the information correct. I was at a science fiction convention where there were two writers on a panel, and one of them was a doctor, and the first writer, who wasn't the doctor, said that she had gotten information where somebody would drink some sort of potion or something, and mm-hmm. it would turn the person white.
Pamela, what's your question?
Hi. I'm an aspiring writer.
Right. No, the thing is you want to know how to avoid pitfalls in researching science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Who would like to answer that? And thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Well, that's the pitfalls to avoid. Something I've always found very useful is that when I finish a piece of science fiction, I like to run it by someone who's more genuinely scientifically literate than I am. David wouldn't have that problem, but...
Ironically, I circulate my manuscripts by at least 40 people. Everything that I publish, it's not from lack of confidence, it's more from a belief from my scientific background that you always benefit from criticism.
I agree with that. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, please.
Well,
please,
when I was writing The Real Science Behind the X-Files, it involves so many different topics. I mean, from cloning to the environment to aging, and topics that are quite outside my own field of virology. And I certainly ran this by a number of other people in the field just to make sure that it was accurate as possible. And what impresses me about Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files, is that he takes the time to actually talk with me on the phone, write up the scripts, send me the scripts, and then he takes every bit of advice that I give him on changes to make to make it a little bit more accurate. And they start filming the next day. So it's a time-consuming process, but then when it's right, it's wonderful. It's a lot better.
Well, having written for X-Files, I can vouch for that. In fact,
he is a perfectionist.
I've come out of my office to do this show, and I have to go back and do finish Act 4 and get it in for tomorrow. And I'm actually concerned that Chris will not believe something that I've done. Although it's in a funny context, because the overall context of the story is completely unbelievable.
But there's a certain honest skepticism there, even when achieving that storyline. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and my guests are David Brin and Simon and William Gibson. We're going to take a short break right now. When we return, we'll continue talking about the substance of the science and science fiction, and we'll keep taking more of your calls at 800-989-8255. At 40 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from National Public Radio Stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans, Ericsson, developing communication solutions that provide freedom of mobility for users the world over. Ericsson helps you to make yourself heard. And Time, offering a big print edition that contains stories at the same length as in the regular print edition. Information available, 800-282-0079. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Racial profiling, that's when cops use skin color as a reason to frisk, or cabs use it as a reason to pass someone by, or why we feel for our wallets in an elevator. As a policy, it's been attacked by the president and Amnesty International as an instinct. It can only be cured by long and brutally honest conversations. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and we'll look at racial profiling on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Tune in at this time tomorrow for discussion about how our memory works, or doesn't, and how it can be improved. Memory loss is our topic tomorrow at this time, so don't forget. Today we're talking about the real science behind science fiction with our guests David Brin, Anne Simon, and William Ford Gibson. If you want to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And we have a bunch of emails here, so I thought maybe I could throw a few of these at you quickly, and you can see if you can provide some quick answers. This is one from Jane in San Mateo. Several years ago, she says, I read a statement that teleportation would take about 50 years to develop. Has anyone started working on this? Now, my understanding is so far they've only been able to teleport a single photon a very short distance. Am I off there?
No, you're right. That's real teleportation. But what they've also been able to do is learn how to take the software for what's called computer-aided design, for designing an implement. Now they can build, now it takes a tenth as many engineers, a tenth as long to design a new airplane, for instance, because they use the computational things. They've been able to take computer-aided design and now send it to a machine that creates cast molds. By writing in plexiglass.
Cast molds?
The plastic that is then used to create a cast mold for then molding apart.
Yeah, but it's like faxing. You wind up with your original remains in its original location.
Right, but you're taking the information out of the computer, sending it to this device, and it makes with a laser beam this object. Now, that's a long way from being able to make a biological entity at the other end, because this is all one piece of plastic. But it's a major help to industry, and it is a kind of transporter.
I think it's a different dream, though. It's replication rather than travel.
Right. You could, if it were sort of infinitely expanded, then you would be able to duplicate yourself somewhere else rather than actually singularly move there.
I actually use a kind of nano fax machine, half jokingly, in my most recent novel. And the thing I found myself wondering about was what it would do to economics. So if these things are set up in the equivalent of 7-Eleven stores all over the world, and people are sending their grandchildren teddy bears eventually.
Or how about sending their grandchildren?
Well, that's what you can't do with the nanofax, but I wondered what would happen with the surplus of objects that would build up, because the original would always remain in Houston and the duplicate would appear in Paris.
Well, in a sense, we live in that world because we all have many, many more objects than our ancestors had. And look at the kids with their Pokemons. The thing is that, what you're dealing with there is sort of the thing that Philip K. Dick would deal with, and that is, what is identity? In a new novel that I'm working on right now, you can make copies of yourself and you yourself continue. Well, this is going to make a very bizarre world. Who gets to use the bank account?
I believe Gerald did that in The Man Who Folded Himself back in the late
60s. That was a wonderful book about time travel.
Which is unfortunately out of print.
Yeah, going all over the place with time travel and meeting yourself. I think that one of the things that you often hear people saying is that if only our maturity and as a species, as people, our sanity had increased at the rate that our technology has increased. And I was watching the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, the other night, and it suddenly struck me that this cliche that people say is exactly opposite from the truth. We don't have the space stations and all those wonderful Jor-El outfits and the fat pills and all those things that we were promised at the end of this century. Turns out getting into space was harder than we thought. But if you look at the astronauts in 2001, they're all white males. And when we send up astronauts, they don't go as far, but they're all different sexes and colors. And we simply refuse to accept the sorts of injustices that when I was a kid in the 50s, we used to see all the time and take for granted. I think the exact opposite thing has happened, and it's partly been because of the literature and the movies that have tweaked our consciences. We have actually improved our souls even faster than our technologies, in my opinion.
Let's go to Rob in Chicago, Illinois. Rob.
Well, from Wells to Huxley to Clark to Asimov to Philip K. Dick and to the modern writers, I mean, who's driving who, science fiction or science fact? I mean, I'm talking to you on a flip phone that looks like a communicator. I'm able to do things on the Internet that just seemed like dreams, and now they're talking about this universal Internet that we may someday be fortunate enough to connect up to know everything that needs to be known, and even nanotechnology in sentient beings that are humanoid in form that are made out of mechanical processes with a switch the size of a molecule that can turn on and off. It will not be difficult for a human form to turn into a starfish. They won't be biologically human, but at some point we're not going to be biologically human anymore either. We're going to put our bodies and minds, put our bodies aside and our minds into new vessels that can do things that we can't even imagine yet.
But be careful, you're blowing the minds of some of the listeners.
That's a long way off, too. I mean, it's not something that's just around the
corner. I'm inclined to think that our great-grandchildren will regard us as some sort of precursor species, but they'll be living on the other side of Werner Vinge's singularity.
Thank you for that. And let's go to Susan in Salt Lake City.
Susan? Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to hear, well, one of the things that I've loved about science fiction, and particularly James Tiptree Jr. and Cordwainer Smith, has to do with human reactions to technology. You know, what will we be? You know, whether we're some, you know, I'm going to call it a disembodied brain, just to tap into the last comment. But, you know, what are we going to be? How we react. I find that one of the most important elements here. And I'd like to hear especially Anne Simon on that, because that's sort of a near term, but also William Gibson. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Whether we're going to end up as disembodied brains?
Oh, I go ahead.
The human element. The human
response
to change.
What will be the impact of technology on all of us? How will we interact
with it? Well, I'm a little worried right now. I'm a little worried because I'm looking at what's happening in Europe, and that's now coming into the United States, where there's this big upheaval about biologically engineered plants. And people are not, their science knowledge isn't keeping up with the technology that's going on around them. And I fear that there's going to be an upheaval over science of this type until people understand exactly what's really going on. So I'm wondering whether or not these huge advances are really going to continue before there's a lot of people who are going to say, no, we don't want this.
Oh, I don't think we have no history of ever having been able to put anything back in the box as a species. We didn't go for it all the way with nuclear weapons, but we've still got enough of them that, you know, we could lose it one day. But we don't put things back in the box. We are already in some very real way post-human. And there's no going back. That reaction in Europe has, they may not be that sophisticated about genetic engineering, but they know an awful lot about multinational capital.
Ooh. Okay. Let's go now to Mary in Norfolk, Virginia. Hello, Mary.
First, I'd like to say to Ms. Simon that I'm a great fan of the X-Files, and to Mr. Gibson that I am a great admirer and reader of his work, even though sometimes I don't understand it all. I try hard.
You don't mean to say you actually understand the X-Files, do you?
I try hard to understand that, too. I really love it.
You can't do better than that.
I especially love the episode where Esther, the cyberpunk girl, and her friend put the AI loose on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And the interaction between Esther and the lone gunman when she's in handcuffs is very exciting. I'd like to know how Mr. Gibson feels about, about movies like The Matrix that take some of his ideas way out in left field, And also, I'm reading an article about scientists doing brain implants now for small pumps that can alleviate depression and perhaps even help memory with stroke or head injured patients. This is the real precursor to his idea of hardwiring and jacking into the brain, and if he has any ideas or feelings about that.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Well, to, you know, I don't know, speak to the second one is sort of easier. It's, I've sort of had that in front of me for a while. I've always thought that the real precursor to the sort of implant technology that I've imagined would be some sort of optical nerve replacement that would allow a blind person a sort of video vision, because the first thing a person with video vision would want would be 50 or 60 channels of cable, and why not? And as soon as one of us has it, then the rest of us will want it.
This is actually a very good point, because a lot of people, wearing my other hat in nonfiction, I wrote a nonfiction book called The Transparent Society that's about the expansion of a human vision through the cameras and human memory through the databases. And people are very concerned about issues of privacy and freedom and whether elites are going to control this information or not. And whether or not we can jack our brains into the internet is beside the point. When you're walking down the street, your eyeglasses will automatically scan the faces of everybody passing by, look up those faces in some big registry of face profiles, and put captions under everybody's face that you pass by. It could include their credit ratings. It could even include their DNA profiles, if you believe Gattaca, the movie, excellent movie Gattaca. The point is that if elites hog these powers, then they will see us, and we won't see them and be able to hold them accountable. But if we all share it, then essentially we're going to get the village back, because in the old village you could know about 1,000 people and know everything about them. In the future, you'll be able to know 6 billion people and everything about them, because of the cameras and the databases will be expanding human vision and human memory. You cannot, as Bill said, cram that technological genie into the bottle. If we panic and pass the wrong laws, we can make sure that only elites have these powers and that we won't.
I'd like to read quickly an email from Bill in Somerville. He said science fiction has never been about the future nearly as much as about the world in which its authors and readers live. Science fiction plays off an essential paradox in science. On the one hand, science tells us that certain things are just not possible, ghosts and demons, etc. On the other hand, it is always shattering our notions of what is possible. It reinvents and reinvokes the whole pantheon of human mythology, angels and demons reappearing as aliens and information viruses.
I'll second that.
Smart guy.
No, that's very good indeed.
So it isn't just about the future, then. It's about the present and even about the past.
Absolutely.
You know, this fellow's so smart, he probably watches The X-Files and reads both Bill's books and mine.
History is always speculative fiction.
And that's all the time we have for today. I would like to thank all who called and wrote this hour, and especially my guests, David Brin, astronomer and author of Foundations Triumph, and Anne Simon, professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at UMass in Amherst, and author of The Real Science Behind the X-Files, and William Ford Gibson, science fiction writer, originator of the term cyberspace, and author of the cyberspace trilogy Neuromancer, Count Zero, and Mona Lisa Overdrive. In Washington, I'm Brooke Gladstone, and this is NPR News.